Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by Mark Christensen. How are you, Mark?
I'm great, Mike. How are you doing?
Really good. It's a holiday weekend there in America. What holiday are you celebrating?
Appropriately enough, it's Memorial Day, which is really about memorializing veterans, but best known among many Americans for the Indianapolis 500.
Aha. Uh-huh. A motor race, and that ties in well with this week's movie, which is Speed Racer, and the Wachowski brothers or Wachowski siblings now tackling anime, and I have to say that they're tackling anime in a style that is meant to be respectful and referential to the original lower budget. I think it was, what was the original show called before it was called Speed Racer in Japan? It was like Mac Go Go or...
Racer Go 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 or...
Racer Go Go.
Something. It was also, it had Mifune in the title too, because it was an homage to Toshiro Mifune.
I loved that show when I was a kid. I used to think that was so cool.
It was called Mac Go Go Go, which I think Go has several different meanings in Japanese, including five. So it was the Mach 5 because Go is also the number five.
Well, you are an incredibly educated chap.
Ich Nissan Chi Go. Okay, we'll get corrected if I'm wrong about that, right?
Yeah, and so we should. Visual effects provided primarily by Digital Domain, but with major effects contributed by a large number of houses, including Sony, Rising Sun Pictures, Booth, amongst others.
Yep.
And
my pals Evil Eye were in there doing some stuff.
A big gun?
Go ahead.
Oh, at Evil Eye?
Evil Eye Pictures here in San Francisco.
What do Evil Eye
ILM
do?
Mostly a compositing shop.
Okay.
And but they go all the way back to the Matrix days, the principals over there. So they were pretty heavily involved in production as well.
Now they worked on Speed's like effectively 2.5D Neighborhood, right?
Yeah, they have a really good, I guess we can post the link in the show notes, an example up online, a breakdown that's actually really revealing of how one of the opening shots in the movie was done.
Yeah, no, I've seen that. It is, as you say, very revealing. And so, of course, the film has been out now for a few weeks and has had a less than stellar reception from the fans. And I must admit, before I ever saw the film, I was of the opinion that either this was going to define a whole new look for commercials and stuff, because it would be just deemed to be the coolest thing ever, or it would be just bubblegum pop and not go down well. And I guess we're not here to review the film per se, but we always like to touch on your initial impressions of the film before we get into the visual effects.
Yeah, well... you know, I hated the movie, but I actually think that the visual work is really astonishing and very worth discussion, and really worth, even if you can't drag yourself into the cinema to see this one before it makes what may be a speedy exit, it was really designed for your Blu-ray player, so it would be a good one to check out and really... you know, kind of explore some of what they did in here, because there's some pretty groundbreaking work.
Yeah, so let's discuss it from a technical point of view, because we don't want to harp on issues that are negative. And I totally agree with you. I think there's some really interesting technical stuff going on here. You mentioned that it's targeted for a Blu-ray output, and in fact it was shot on the F23, Sony's effectively HD cinema camera. It has a smaller sensor than, say, the Red, and tends to use HD style lenses. And interestingly, we got to speak to the guys at Digital Domain for a story that's probably up now as you're listening to this, and they did do full tests on the F23 to make it look 100% like film. In other words, to make it go all the way through to being a filmic non-bubblegum looking kind of thing, if that makes sense.
That was thrown away.
And then that went the other way, yeah. And it was, so therefore, obviously not something that they were forced into, not that you would expect that they would be at this budgetary level, but it certainly was the case that they got it to what they considered within a hair's breadth of 35 mil in terms of just like a final look. But then they, in the process of doing that testing, discovered that they could get this super saturated look. And I must say, David Tattersall, who was the DOP, I have an enormous amount of respect for, and he has a lot of experience going in from obviously episode 1, 2, and 3 of Star Wars and stuff. And Owen Patterson, the production designer from The Matrix, is another very respected individual. But I guess the thing that we need to discuss is the fact that this really wasn't a film for the DOP or for the production designer to flex their creative muscles, because this really was a green screen feature.
It was a green screen feature. It was a matte painting extravaganza. There was also all this crazy location still photography that went into doing a lot of the environments. But yeah, you're right. I think those guys probably were pretty handcuffed in terms of their work on this one.
So now let's discuss that. As I said, they were shooting with the F-23, and they shot using the Hypergamma 4 curve to get out a so basically modified Rec 709 kind of gamma curve. So they were trying to get something that was giving them a reasonable amount of latitude, and the F-23 has a reasonable amount of latitude. And then they took the files into, I think on set, a codex box, and basically started the workflow that was, you know, 10-bit DPX log files to the various equipment manufacturers, the post houses. But in the process of going from their finals, and certainly during review with monitor LUTs, they were basically heading for this super saturated look that was, you know, this big deliberate post-production effect. And in addition to that, which I guess is obvious even if you've only seen the trailer, they went for something that we almost rarely ever have a chance to discuss, which is actually doing shots that are creatively or rather technically wrong. And you alluded to this with the still photography. So maybe you could run us through what they were doing in terms of bubbles and why it was technically wrong.
Sure. The bubbles were shot by this group. Now, let me get the names straight here. So we've got the world unit headed up by this guy, Dennis Martin, who I think was at ILM. And he went with a still camera and a little crew all over the place into the mountains and deserts of the world, and shot a bunch of 360s with I think it was a Canon 5D, so very high resolution stitchable stills. And I think that these actually then, when you talk about David Tattersall being a little handcuffed, those actually were on set. They'd already been taken when they shot it, so the shots had to be locked to those 360s, even though they weren't then finalized. What then happened to a lot of them is they were then painted over as matte paintings, I believe, by Lubo Ristov and his crew. And that sounds like he was credited as being a kind of Escher-esque, M.C. Escher-esque artist for what he pulled off, because if you look at these things, they're crazy. Or if you've ever seen a QuickTime VR when it's unfolded, in a flat view, you know, it's pretty nutty looking. And then that made it nearly impossible, from what I can understand, for any of the compers to actually match elements together in a moving shot, because it just wasn't possible. There is no lens that exists in the world that matches what they had, right?
But I think more than that, like, let's just be really clear about this. These guys had used HDR imaging before with The Matrix, right? I mean, they'd done 360-degree virtual environments. It was an extension of the work they'd done on the first Matrix with Bullet Time to build that.
Well, the Burly Brawl in the second movie.
So it wasn't that they couldn't do it, if you know what I mean.
No, absolutely not.
It was that they chose to basically place their actors inside a virtual bubble, which if you're standing inside a virtual bubble, and you didn't move from the center line and just looked left and right and up and down, it is a true, accurate representation of what you would see. There's no parallax shift that you would have. Like if you're looking through a window out to the ocean and you just pivot on the same point, the ocean relative to the window doesn't move relative to you. Right? You know, it might move out of your field of view, but it doesn't actually technically do anything wrong. It's only if you start moving around, and I know you know this, Mark, but just for those that are listening. And and so what they did is they said, well, okay, that would work perfectly if we never moved the camera, but we will move the camera. But instead of reconstructing a 3D world from our HDRs that we've got, you know what? We'll keep this kind of digital equivalent of a rostrum camera background rig so that the backgrounds will kind of slide a bit underneath people and behind them. But it'll be familiar if you've ever seen, you know, Speed Racer, and you've got those sort of background plates that shift to give the illusion of movement for foreground drawing. And so if it broke too much, then they would actually make a few cardboard cutouts effectively with stuff mapped on it. But all this is real footage, of course. This is real photos of real stuff. And then they would sort of put
those
in. Still footage. But of course, that doesn't work when you do cars. So what we're mainly discussing here is a shot where they're at the house and where they're, you know, interacting with each other. Because once you get in the cars, that whole idea of moving off a single central point of a bubble kind of goes out the window because you're moving at like hundreds of miles an hour.
Right. I mean, they deliberately did a lot of panning around various environments, rooms that the characters are in. There's a big party at one point and things out the window. And yeah, I mean, they just decided to completely cheat. And, you know, not only did they completely ignore, say, any natural motion that was in the real shot, like the Coppers were, I think, given license to just completely override that. They weren't matching lenses. They were putting together shots that had elements all shot with different lenses. They were putting together elements that had no depth of field. Like everything was shot to be completely crystal clear. So they deliberately broke a lot of rules. And you know, at the film, I was thinking about doing this podcast and thinking, wow, this is going to be a trick because, you know, we have to evaluate them by their own rules, right? Like, I mean, there's no sense in taking them to task for being kind of creative with the world of their film. And actually, I think that this stuff is some of what's really most interesting about this movie. What really makes it worth seeing is how far they pushed all of it. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think more than anything, it's going to make it great to get the two-disc DVD with hopefully, you know, making of stuff, because I think this will go much better on DVD than it will at the cinema. It feels like it's an experiment in pushing things. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, I'm just being blunt, sometimes you kind of need to fail and you have to not fear failure, because if you fear failure, you just get mediocrity. So I understand the film got panned, but by the same token, you've got to take your hats off to the visual effects team for leaving what is now a fairly safe world of a traditional pipeline of, you know, Mayer and Nuke and Comping and Shake or whatever, and putting stuff together and going for it in terms of getting some amazingly outrageous approaches visual effects. And of course, all in what is theoretically an homage to anime. So how can I put this? They're not being self-indulgent. They're doing it because they're trying to make a digital live-action anime. And I guess to a certain extent, that's what the best part about the first Matrix film was, right? It was like a graphic novel.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with you a little bit in how reverent they were. There is one scene where there's some actual anime in, you know, movie in the movie, and it did make me long a little bit for some of the clarity of that style. These guys went all over the place with it and, you know, made up their own rules for a lot of stuff, some of which is really cool. But, you know, some of it just looked, I don't know if I'd say wrong, but I'll give you an example. There's a shot early on, I don't know if you remember this one, but there's a bomb, you know, that's sent into the garage, and they have to send it out of the garage in a baby carriage or something, or it's rolled out into the street anyway to blow up. Do you remember that explosion shot that was, you know, out in the street?
Yeah.
It was just the weirdest thing. It's like, I mean, what happened? It was like a comic book rip or something happened. I couldn't I couldn't even quite parse what that was.
Well, I'm with you, and I'm not saying. I guess my point is, if you start with The Matrix 1, and say that it moved towards the graphic novel, then you've got the whole Rodriguez, Sin City thing, which was an incredibly graphical attempt to try and bring a graphic novel to life, and of course 300 thrown in. And my point would be, if you draw a line from Matrix through those and then say, well, where would you go next? What they tried to do effectively is find the visual graphical cool version of the 60s comic. The trouble is, I don't know that the limitations of the animation style were what made Speed Racer cool.
Yeah, and what they ended up with, I mean, since you mentioned Rodriguez, is kind of a no fun version of Spy Kids 3D in a way. And I do kind of wonder if some things really worked against them. Going back a second to the fact that they had, the F-23 all lined up to deliver, and I don't know if you saw any of those tests. You can geek out here a little bit with the actual look of those files. I mean, was the highlight roll off and everything looking really right?
I did not see those tests, but I do know that in talking to the senior guys at Digital Domain, they said that with a serious degree of accuracy, they were able to make the F-23 stuff look like film. With all of the characteristics that they would expect for well-shot film, yeah? Because the highlight roll-offs that you describe can be managed by a good DOP like David Tattersall, right? And you've got more latitude than in most digital cameras in the F-23, and if you, shoot in green screen in very controlled conditions, which they primarily were, then, I know that Digital Domain reckon they got the greatest green screens they've ever seen in their life off this camera, and this is upstream of the visual look of the film. They were pulling keys in a quarter of the time they would off film. So yeah, it was just the best shot stuff they'd ever had. And as a consequence, and the thing you mentioned before about having that on-set preview, which is actually a thing called Sparky, which was a real-time comping thing they had on set to line up those virtual worlds, at that stage in the production, they're technically immaculate. Do you know what I mean? Now, I think the thing comes from this, let's go crazy on all fours. And something you haven't discussed, and it's completely applicable to all of this, is the cars. Because they did exactly the same thing with the cars, right? What they developed with, and I think it's one of the most interesting aspects of the film, I actually find the VR stuff it doesn't sing to me. But what I found was interesting was how well they could do the cars, right? And with the cars, they got to an incredibly high degree of realism. And then having got that, having nailed it, having completely got the materials and the clear coat and the subtle spec highlights and the way that it worked in a real-world environment and built what is probably now one of the world's best global illumination pipelines, they then stuck on top of it a whole lot of extra lights for creative effect to get, extra liquid shadow reflections and extra pings and highlights and, stuff from the... Because obviously the racing environments were... Well, two of the racing environments in particular, the Grand Prix and Thunderhead at the beginning and stuff, were very light, specular, rich. And so they sort of took the car to a level of realism, and then they, on top of that, laid in huge amounts of bling and then made the cars do kung fu crap, which, I don't buy into that much. I must be getting old.
Well, it wasn't, just on that note, I think there was a problem with just not, there was no sense of, anticipation in any of that stuff. And I even remember in the original show, there was a little more sense of danger that, how's he going to get out of this with his 8 buttons on his steering wheel or whatever. And, and it would sometimes be really remarkable that, there'd be something new that you didn't know, or, it seemed like there was some surprise. Whereas in this one, it was really more like a montage where you're trying to catch up to what are even the rules of this racing universe. And some of them were, confusing. They had these guys turn into foam or something when they crash. And
But see, the thing is that even at the compositing level, right? Because I'm desperate to stay on the technical.
Yeah,
because I don't want to die into the. I just don't want to be Siskel and Ebert. The thing is that on the technical level, right? As you'd know, the shutter on a digital camera can be 180 or it can be 360. In other words, it can look filmic and have a motion blur that's you'd get from half of the exposure time having the shutter open. And in fact, when they go to these fully digital rigs, all you had in terms of live action was a guy sitting in a cockpit and everything else. Like the Mark VI never existed. The Mark V, they had a couple of, like they had two cars they made like mock-ups of, but they weren't even exactly right to what appeared in the film. And they were just for ones where they were sitting in, you know, when they had the sitting in the houses, the cars just as like props they were walking around.
Yeah.
So those were like non-moving ones. But once it moved, it's digital. And Mark VI never existed in anything but digital. So you've got a guy in a cockpit. So now they're trying to put in the motion blur. And whereas normally we'd be like evaluating the shot for whether you're trying to blur out the background or sharpen the foreground, they were actually mixing it up in the same shot. So they'd be like, well, there'd be ridiculous amounts of motion blur here, half what you'd normally have there. And then they'd overlay a second version of... and they'd overlay a whole second version of the ton of motion blur to get that kind of soft, you know, dry brush stroke effect that you get on old cartoons. And so my problem is that I know it's my problem, but my point of view is that, you know, you take it to realism and then you just screw with it completely. And then that's a creative journey that you're either going to succeed on or fail. And if you fail creatively, well, I applaud you for trying, but it didn't look very good.
Yeah, but this is going to be great reference. I mean, for those listening to the show who do this stuff and are ever asked, you know, make me something I've never seen before, well, a lot of people will not have seen Speed Racer, and you should check it out because they really kind of invented a lot of their own optics for this. I mean, what about all the crazy circles of confusion that take on shapes describing what's going on in the story, like hearts?
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean... we might have really hated it, but, you know, you have to admit, it looked pretty cool.
Well, this is my thing. I think that we may look back more favorably in time at Speed Racer as being a liberator of certain things for certain types of things. Because, you know, once you get all this power and you can pull it off, is it enough to just stop at realism? And unfortunately, what we're waiting for, I think, is the... how can I put this? You're waiting for the film that breaks all the rules but does it with such a magnificent piece of storytelling that, you know, it's enchanting beyond belief. And so the problem is that we constantly confuse, you know, I guess deliberately, the storytelling with the visual effects. And here, if the areas of confusion, like the defocusing of the lights, had gone to things that were so cool and so worked for the story that we just loved them to death, then... you know, but then if it's sort of cheesy and hearts and stuff, then we kind of kick back. But I bet you that's going to be adopted by the first chocolate commercial that gets made with somebody coming out of the cinema going, hey, I got an idea.
Oh, heck yeah. And a lot of the optics were really cool looking. I mean, the ice cave stuff, I just thought that whole sequence looked really cool.
Yeah, I have the same problem, though, with the dynamics, you see, because the cars were designed in terms of a rig to actually respond to racing the way cars would race, right? Like they would go down on the wheels based on the suspension, based on the torque of
In fact, the setup was done a lot like it would be done for a video game. They kind of made it sort of good to go for the animators. You know, it was all rigged and, you know, ready to just run them around.
Yeah, but unfortunately... they could then override that and happily make the cars do things that, you know, would lift at the front where they should go down and just look cool. And I think what will happen is that Digital Domain, I sort of know this for a fact, that they've stated it, that they're going to take a lot of that technology back into their commercials division, right? And you'll end up with some awesome car commercials coming out of Digital Domain, but they'll be much more tempered by the real world, because obviously you're trying to sell a car, you don't want it to look like a toy. But people will just be stunned at how cool these car commercials are, because they've just had the most amazing R&D project of sort of breaking the laws in Speed Racer. And it's not just Digital Domain, of course, because we shouldn't skip over the great contributions of the other places like, you know, Sony Imageworks and others. But obviously, you know, Digital Domain was a lead house on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, ILM even threw in there with John Knoll himself getting involved on this one. So there were a lot of high-level people who really thought this was a kind of a cool challenge, not a run-of-the-mill project by any means.
Yeah, and I guess it's, you know, if you had to speak in terms of technical stuff, like the quality and complexity of, let's just start with that Thunderhead opening, right? Like that is mm-hmm. just one hell of a virtual environment to be hooning around. I mean, you know, prior to that, I would have said the pod race was kind of image complexity wise a killer for racing. But oh my God, the level of complexity in that was just off the dial. Now,
yeah, absolutely. And you had the sense that you'd really never seen that look before. I mean, did you feel like, I mean, I thought maybe in a computer game, sort of, but, you know, it was obviously a lot more detailed than that.
Do you play a lot of computer games?
No, not a lot. I stay familiar with them.
I guess I wonder that, whether the computer game guys are trying to look more cinematic and the film industry is trying to look more computer gamey, if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, you know, we haven't mentioned John Gaeta, but he did cite computer games and the relationship between cinema and them as a big inspiration and, you know, did this kind of visionary prognostication, as he likes to do, about kind of the near-term future, 5 to 8 years out, being one where you can take these 360 environments and, you know, interact in them real time on a game box. And, you know, I think a guy like that would have you, you know, have you say, well, cinema's going to actually have to follow Interactive's lead on some of this stuff, which, you know, I mean, does explain some of the kind of non-cinematic qualities of this movie.
I guess, and I'm going to fess up to a personal thing here, right? It just feels like just when digital cinematography got to the point that we can do accurate depth of field to model 35, like we've got, like in my case, a red camera has 35mm lenses, 35mm depth of field. It looks very cinematic, and all the rest of the crowd goes, "Whoa, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to have infinite depth of field and make it look like video." It's like the same, which they wouldn't have done if they couldn't have made it look like film first. If that makes sense, it's like,
no, I mean, everything you said about the F23 gives it the ultimate irony.
Yeah,
and of course that won't. None of that is wasted, but you're right.
It's like, well, you just keep moving the darn goalposts. You just made our digital stuff look like it was.
I do wonder if that. I think a lot of people didn't watch this movie, and I'm not turning into Siskel and Ebert with this one. I don't think that bright and full scale a color palette is very cinematic. And I mean, I'll tell you, I had the option of watching this one in IMAX, and I just didn't think my retina.
Oh no, you'd be bleeding. But you know, here's the thing, though. I've got to wonder. Like, well, firstly, I do honestly believe it's a Blu-ray thing almost. But
yeah, and it'll look completely different there, right? I mean, I bet they'll. Do you think they'll go direct digital?
Oh,
to...
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
They probably will. Yeah.
But I don't know. For me, it's more like There's a problem I have, which I had with a bunch of films lately, which is that if this was a kids' film aimed at my kids, then I'd have bought the pop colors. But it's not a kids' film. So I wonder,
yeah.
I just keep getting into this sort of aspirational aesthetic, right? Like, it's really easy to know what a Sin City is aimed at because it's dark and it's moody and it's, you know, and it's a graphical, non-photoreal thing aimed at a target audience with the kind of right thing. And you could make a... Not that they are, but you could make like a Batman film exactly like that, right? And it would be tough and cool. And but you're not going to make, you know, SpongeBob kind of, you know, film that way. You're not going to make a dark and eerie version of Josie and the Pussycats, right? Like like, you know.
I like how you almost said putty tats.
I know, though. I did. I'm sorry, but I was just trying to think of a good cartoon that would be known universally. And maybe picked the wrong one, but I was going for a non-Disney one. But you know what I'm trying to say, right? Like, there's a...
Yeah, yeah.
If this had been a much more kids-aimed film and it was rich and colourful and eye candy and wasn't an assault on the senses, and I mean, I would not take my kids to this because, it, you know, they block their ears and, you know, I mean, it's just not aimed at them.
Well, again, I mean, Spy Kids 3D versus Sin City, like, same guy made them.
Yeah.
They both have a kind of a sense of humor about them that in all of the Wachowski films is kind of replaced by this dark paranoia that never really goes away.
Yeah, I just think
now I'm turning into Siskel and Ebert,
no,
so
but
I better
I think
stop.
It's, no, but I think it's also like about visual style. I think that and now I guess we're talking about the DI, because a lot of this is you're talking about, you know, the color and the vibrancy of it and the overcranked saturation and stuff.
A huge palette.
Yeah, it's just.
I mean, most films have a color or three. This one had all of them.
just had way more than all of them. Yeah. I can't imagine what it'd be like for an actor like John Goodman or somebody on set as well, because it's, you know, it's hard to, I guess you kind of do a film like this to buy into the vision of, you know, somebody, and it would have been impossible to know that far out much about it. But every time I see hyper real or hyper stylized, I'm pretty nervous, I must admit. I do like a good you know, kind of grounded film, and I mean that visually. I mean, like, in terms of actually having the audience have understanding of geography, and that's something that I get annoyed when I kind of lose track of which way is up in some of these things. Do you know what I mean? I know that that's a look and a style, but I like to have an orientation to the scene, the what's going on. I don't mind it, you know, going wild for a bit, but I want to have some idea what's going on. And it could be a fight scene and it could be a car race. I think disorientating the audience because, quote, it's the, you know, the kids of the MTV generation who just, you know, can visually decode so fast. And I say that's true. I think that at some point it's your audience disengages from trying to work it out and just starts to let it wash over. And then once you're letting it wash over, you're not emotionally caring, and consequently, you know, it's harder to make a shot work.
Well, ironically, too, you've kind of made a video game cutscene for the generation that, by and large, is ignoring movies much more than previous generations of that age. I mean, just statistically, that's what's happening.
I don't know about you, but when I play video games, there seems to be a remarkable lack of edits.
Right.
I'm driving down the road.
Especially the driving ones.
and I just keep getting the view out the front window. And if I'm doing a point of view shooter, I tend to have the end of my gun in shot a lot. I guess that's the cross
Although
between
Grand Theft Auto's, you know, got more going on than that, but yeah.
And were you a fan of the original Speed Racer?
The original cartoon, sure. I mean, it was so odd, you know, the fast chattery talk, and I don't know. I mean, I thought, you know, the car was always just remarkably cool, and I was definitely a car buff when I was a kid. So that alone, I think I was won over. But
so
there
was
something.
Here's my other question to you, right? My other problem with doing this entire genre is, if you actually went back and were forced to sit through three or four episodes of Speed Racer now, would they be as good as you remember them? See, this is my thing, right? Like, I remember them as being the coolest thing since God, right? Now, I might watch them now and go, this is really lame. But, you know, I remember them as being...
I remember them seeming kind of odd and a little disconnected and, you know, very kind of hard-boiled kind of quality to them. And but there's also something kind of sparse about them, that there's nothing sparse in this movie whatsoever.
So I guess at the end of the day, we're not really faulting the visual effects so much as we are saying that the visual effects obviously are capable of anything they want. They chose this creatively, and,
No, I think we're championing actually the visual effects. I think they met their brief. They went for it, and, you know, I mean, it may not be to your taste, but it's definitely worth checking out and learning a little bit about what they did. As you say, disc two of this one will have a lot of surprises on it that may inspire more good ideas.
I actually think you're absolutely right. I think this is definitely one that would sit in my library of films that I would want to be able to reference, but not necessarily the film that I'm going to leap for on a Saturday night when I want to sit down with my wife and have an enjoyable experience in front of the fire.
Right. You think you lost your mind.
Yeah. But having said that, again, just to repeat, we do... we do have this enormous problem of breaking what is phenomenal visual effects contribution from the various facilities that worked on it, from, you know, turning into Siskel and Ebert and arguing about whether or not...
Well, and admittedly, I mean, look, in our industry, when you try to sell a look, I mean, if you're telling somebody, you know, it's like a speed racer kind of thing, people are going to lose interest, right? Because, I mean, it does come up. It's not just our problem on this show. It's everyone's problem. I mean, if this thing had been a hit, you know, you'd see a lot of... I mean, it would become a whole style of its own. They, I would say, didn't... I mean, I think they landed it in terms of what they were trying to do stylistically, and I think somebody else might nail something similar, minus maybe one or two of the salient qualities of this, and go a lot further, as you say, dramatically, and that will be the one that gets all the credit, just as The Matrix did. I mean, The Matrix used what seemed at the time like brand new, never been seen techniques, but really what it did was just wed those so well to the story that they just seem astonishing, right?
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I would also say that the visual effects look, the kind of slick, cool, whoa factor, very much suited the story, very much suited the demographic that they're aimed at, very much all worked in sync. And
yeah.
And it's not that these guys didn't, it's just that at the end of the day, it is impossible to push it this hard and not run the risk of, you know, literally failing to connect with the audience. But as I said a couple of times now, I do applaud the guys for having the balls to do it. And I just, you know, would hate to be in a situation that riskier projects were never made, because that would be the worst thing, right? That, like, no one's actually tried anything new in ages. And
well, and that is a slight danger for all of us, because every time one of these things is made for six, you know, digit amounts of money, and then brings in a kind of paltry amount. I mean, I imagine one way or another this thing will make its money back, but it's going to take a while. And, you know, that's not good for any of us, especially in these times.
I can't imagine a lot of people talking in back room at Cannes, you know, joking about how they've got this amazing anime electric blue thing they want to make that's going to rock this universe. But you know what? I mean, perhaps time will I'm always surprised when I read about films like, I don't know, 2001 or even Fantasia, that were box office flops that were considered to be not very engaging with the audience, and, you know, then turn into classics in years to come. I'm pretty safe, I think, in saying this will not become the classic Fantasia of its generation. But, hey, I could be wrong.
Yeah. Actually, truthfully, they did some interesting things with the story, too. It you know, lacked a couple things that I like to see in a film, like humor, but it had, you know, I mean, it really used the, you know, the hero's journey model and some pretty complicated overlapping stories. And we haven't even talked about some of the almost motion graphics element of this film, like the wipes using people.
Yeah.
Which not everybody may have seen.
Yeah.
It's just some...
You know,
and those were used for exposition, right? I mean, sometimes these people were
one of the stories I haven't certainly heard about much is the editing of it. I mean, I would really like to know, because you know, we spoke recently about Iron Man and stuff, which I think was all edited HD. But you'd have to be thinking in a film this complicated that, and I know that, you know, on new there's currently a big budget production, and I can't say which one it is, but I know they have 13 Avids on it with 50 terabytes of data. Just for offline, right? And the complexity on a film like this. But then again, you know, you wouldn't have necessarily, you know, be like, well, insert large race footage here. So it's you know, really mixing it up in terms of what you would call pre and post and offline and online, because, you know, what are you gonna do? You've got to edit effectively the VFX as an ongoing process. You can't come to this like a traditional offline editor. And if anyone's got any great links to the editing side of this story, please post them in, because we'd love to. I certainly would find to find out more about the editing side of this and how the editors work. Because, I mean, I just be stunned at what you do when you'd sit down at the beginning of the project to say, right, so how are we going to put this together and whether or not it was almost by numbers, in the sense that it was all planned out and the shots were shot for the shot that they wanted, or whether there was vast kind of coverage and high shooting ratios, and that, you know, scenes were recut dramatically and differently from what they were envisaged when they filmed them. You know, because that obviously...
You do wonder, yeah.
That obviously does
happen. It's hard to imagine in this film that a lot of stuff ended up on the cutting room floor because it didn't serve the story. I think, you know, it would be whether it worked visually or not. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was just, you know, ridiculous amounts of complexity in some of these things. And I wonder whether, I just don't know, I wonder whether it was just too complex to edit in that kind of a sense. Did they just keep going back and asking for new shots, and how much flexibility they had in putting that edit together? I, as you know, love editors, and I think editors do insanely cool jobs in helping to tell the story, but you don't know, you know, how constrained they are and how much that they have the sit back and considerate aspects that you want from an editor, to just really think about how the story flows for the audience.
Right.
Anyway, I don't want to finish on a down note, but certainly I did. Our research team did an astonishingly good job on putting stuff together for the. But I just don't think whole lot of stuff out there right now on the on what's been going on with the editing, and maybe that'll come out in weeks and days to come.
Yeah, I mean, Roger Barton, I'm just checking now, he's got a Wikipedia entry, but I don't see any actual interviews with him. So, you know, maybe effects guy. We want to track him down.
We actually have a great story. We actually have two great stories. We have a story on Speed Racer, as I mentioned. There's also another one we're doing on just how to make a digital car, because it's actually pretty interesting, the Mental Ray global illumination path that they took on this film. And by comparison, say, on Iron Man, which also has, of course, metallic car-like finishes over CG metalwork, took a RenderMan approach. And so some really interesting comparisons to be drawn between the two approaches. And RenderMan had the benefit of Pixar having done Cars. So obviously that was a sort of a ground that Pixar had to work its way through. And companies like ILM now are using those RenderMan technologies, such as the photon mapping and brick map stuff that we get into in the article. And by contrast, the guys here at, say, Digital Domain were using Mental Ray, and apparently the Autodesk guys really came through for them in terms of providing new variations to Mental Ray and pushing the craft, because the complexity of the scenes was so great they wouldn't have been able to render them otherwise. And hopefully that'll actually drift into general broader optimizations going into Mental Ray from the Autodesk team that the rest of our community can enjoy. Because Mental Ray, I think, I don't know if you agree with me, but I think personally Mental Ray in that area could do with some optimizations and stuff to move it forward.
Yeah, I guess it can get pretty slow and cumbersome.
Oh, especially on the complexity that we're seeing in one of those race sequences where, you know, the whole VR thing doesn't work because you're just hurling around the set at such astonishing rates.
Yep. Yeah, they did actually get away with this thing, for example, putting the car on a treadmill and letting everything else move, and letting the thing with all the polygons in it just sit.
Right.
That's, you know, that was good. In this film, you could do that.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, the environment of Thunderhead Track was itself, you know, a really non-forgiving track. Anything that's raised up, which has that much kind of, you know, sight to be seen kind of thing, that much kind of open, you know, I mean, individual cars had like 40 layers of buffers in nukes because they just needed, not only did they have the global illumination solution, but they had all of these other things to do with Z-maps and the various nuke gizmos having to allow them to do car relighting stuff to add in all of that extra, I call bling or ping on their cars and stuff. So the render, I don't know, the weight that was put on Mental Ray was pretty astonishing. And yet they did a full absolute global illumination solution with ray tracing. Ray tracing being the absolute, you know, pivotal cornerstone of what you need to pull off realistic cars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so like, thanks so much for taking time on your holiday weekend to discuss this. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks also to our producers and our team who put together the show each week and who toil away at the Pixel Corp. We really appreciate all the efforts of the team there.
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for this unbelievable 60-page dossier on this one.
Until next time, where we should be discussing Indiana Jones. Have you seen Indy yet?
I haven't.
I think David's joining us for our Indy discussion, and it'd be interesting to see his take on what is, after all, one of the more anticipated films of the year. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour, and it's goodbye from me, and it's...
Mark Christensen, and can we say keep it real on this one? Let's just say it.
Okay, until later. See you guys. Bye.